Today is the 31st of December in 2014. We are at the home of Jeff Ingram in Tucson, Arizona. This is our third interview with Jeff. Two prior interviews were conducted in November of this year. Jeff, can you spell for me your last name?
I-N-G-R-A-M.
And in our last interviews, we had talked about your childhood and your education, the teachers that had inspired you. We had talked about your travels to the West, looking for a place to stay and kind of anchor in, and that turned out to be Santa Fe. Talked about meeting Brower and some information on David Brower. And then Martin Litton and your river trip in 1966. Talked about some of the hiking that you did in the canyon, being bit by a rattlesnake, and some discussions about Martin Litton in the 60s. Maybe you could pick up the thread with sort of the late 60s into the early 70s.
Okay. The thread that runs through the late 60s, from the late 60s, through all the 1970s and into the first couple of years of the 80s is the political action that was centered around the, let's say, the fight over, on the one hand, river traffic management, which meant river traffic management by the Park Service, by Dragon Canyon National Park, which in one way or another exercised control over the river from the Paria to Grand Wash Cliffs, that is to say through the entire Grand Canyon, even though there were various jurisdictions before 1975. For instance, there were some Forest Service lands that came down to the river, some BLM lands came to the river, and of course there were water and power withdrawals, which gave the Bureau of Reclamation a say. And down at the far end, Lake Mead National Recreation Area was the presiding Park Service jurisdiction for the last 40 miles. The upper end, the slack water, has various designations. But anyway, that area influenced by Lake Mead, the reservoir from behind Hoover Dam. But nevertheless, it was the administration of the park that really was the major player in how people got to use the river. And that had definitely already started in, who knows, the 50s. Maybe there was something they did. I've certainly seen papers that make the 1960s the time when the Park Service began to gather its bureaucratic wits about it and say, we need to do something about people going down this river because they're all going to die and then we'll be responsible and so on. Let me pick up another strand. So at the same time, at the end of the 60s, there was a very active effort to implement the Wilderness Act, which meant in terms of the parks, each park had to be studied and recommendations made, and then a recommendation by the president sent to Congress to set up wildernesses for the national parks. There weren't any wildernesses in the sense that there had been Forest Service wildernesses from the 1920s. So the Park Service had some resistance to what they considered to be, in some sense, a superfluous designation. They thought a national park was the highest designation for a piece of land. I'm not sure they called them wilderness parks back then. I don't think they did. I think they called them great natural places, maybe. Conserve the scenic objects. They talked a lot about scenery. And, of course, archaeological ruins or specimens of things like the petrified forest. Those were also something that turned the Park Service on. But preserving a place because it was a great wilderness was not what the Park Service talked about in the 50s and the 60s. The Wilderness Act changed all that. 1964 was the Wilderness Act, of course. And so the Park Service was faced with a question, well, what do we mean by wilderness? If we have an area designated as a wilderness by Congress, how are we going to manage it? And there was a lot of discussion and debate, conflict even, over the Park Service's efforts. For instance, the Park Service believed that a wilderness inside the park, even no matter what it abutted on, had to be buffered. So there would always be at least an eighth of a mile around a wilderness inside the park. We thought that was silly and ridiculous. And eventually the Park Service dropped that kind of finicky stuff. But there were questions about dirt roads. Do they get closed if they're not used? And there was, to the most important point for the Grand Canyon, there was the question, if there was an established use on a river that used motors, then did a wilderness in the park mean that that use had to be removed, or did it mean that the use could continue? Now, the reason that the Wilderness Act was ambiguous had nothing to do with the parks or the Grand Canyon. It had to do with the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, where there was a political exception made. The local, in fact, the very important Senator Hubert Humphrey, was, I'm sure, lobbied by the outfitters in that area, who were from Minnesota, many of them, and in order to be able to keep on using their motors. So there was an exception written into the Wilderness Act for that, and other people came to understand that as meaning that, well, if you had any existing use of motors, then in order to have a wilderness, you either had to decide to continue the use of motors or you had to ban them. And what did that mean as far as the terms, the definition of wilderness? So that was an important issue, or even the important issue, that was going to be dealt with in the 1960s and 70s, because in the 1950s, people began using big rafts with motors, Georgie White being the pioneer, to push their rafts through at a higher rate of speed, or at least to steer them, and to control them, if you will, with the idea being that they could then carry a lot of paying passengers. So it became then a proposition which was tainted by commercial considerations. That is, we need motors whether there's a wilderness or not, because we have a business, and that's most important. And by the time we get to the end of the 1960s, the Park Service, in wrestling with these issues, wrestling with these issues, which were intensified because putting people through the river, through the canyon on the river, turned out to be a popular thing to do. So there were actually, it turned out, a total of 21 different companies, private companies, who were running trips of various sizes, various numbers of times. Some of them took thousands of people a year. Some of them only took a few dozen. But it was, by and large, not heavily regulated. The Park Service would issue permits, but they didn't turn these into a concession until the end of the 60s, and then around 1970. And what they did was say, all right, we are going to not do permits, we're going to write contracts, and you are going to be a concessionaire of the National Park Service, and you'll be bound by the concession rules and the contracts, which of course then became very complicated and all full of kinds of stuff. But the main thing in looking at the river was, at that time, river management at that time, was that really what the Park Service was doing was codifying in regulations what the commercial operators had already done. So it's not as if the Park Service said, let's start from the beginning and make sure we do this right. They just looked at what they saw, which was, as I say, 21 companies. About what? I'm not sure I remember the number anymore. Was it 10, 12? Motor, we choose motors and the rest of them were all rowing. But in any case, the number of passengers carried by the motorized rafts, because they were bigger and could carry more, was a much larger percentage. And I have to say that all those facts and stuff are contained in my book about the river, hijacking a river. And the important point here is that the commercial operators took the view that the Park Service, in granting them, in working out contracts with them, were going to pretty much allow them to do what they could do, what they wanted to do. It was a kind of, look, Park Service, we've successfully done this service, we're growing, we want to continue to grow and provide this service, so you make this, if not easy, then you make this convenient. The problem was that the number of people that they were taking down expanded greatly. In 1966, it was 1,100. By the time we get to 1970, 71, it was already up to 20,000. The point, whatever the numbers were, and again, they're in my book, the growth was phenomenal and uncontrolled. They were simply taking down whatever number of people that they felt they could carry, given the trips that they, that by they, I mean the commercial operators, wanted to take down. Very important side effect, which was for many of us the most important effect, were the environmental, the huge negative environmental impacts on the river shore. And the Park Service quickly came to believe that it had to do something about how people were using the river. What that means is things like firewood. There was a lot of wood that had floated into the canyon previous years. It was being burned up at a great rate because people like to have big fires. Park Service said, is that a good thing? What will happen when there's no more wood because the Glen Canyon Dam keeps big floods from coming? And what happens to the beaches, which get filled with ash and cinders and are starting to look terrible? Another big problem, of course, was the disposal of human waste. When I went through in 66, people took toilet paper and went off, often around a rock on the beach. or maybe up the slope a little bit. When there were 1,100 people going down, and we went in September, that was pretty bad. The notion that it could be sustained when you were sending 20,000 through was impossible to believe. So the Park Service was starting to deal with the demand by commercial operators. It was starting to deal with a growing environmental, I think it's fair to say, disaster for the river shore. But they tried to do all this within the framework of what existed, existing concession law, and existing demand by the commercial operators, so that the, I should say at this point that I had been Southwest representative of the Sierra Club up through 1969, and then I spent 3 years in the eastern part of the country before coming back in 1972. And those 3 years happened to be the years when everything went, I think, haywire. Not that it was anything to do with me, but when the environmental impacts were intensifying because of the number of people, the number of people were exploding, the Park Service was doing contracts. What kind of contracts would they be? Who was looking at it? What kind of public oversight would there be of this extremely important a national park, if you want to call it, but the resource, the river, etc. And these questions were all being answered with bad answers. The control of the concessionaires was minimal. The environmental impacts were, as I say, growing. The impacts of the number of people who were going down was growing. And the Wilderness Act was not considered to be relevant, particularly by the Park Service. This was a time when there was a superintendent who was woefully inexperienced and made some really bad decisions. Now, by inexperienced, I mean he had never been a land manager, before he was made superintendent of the park. For a major park like the Canyon, that's virtually unheard of. He had been in personnel work, and one has to believe that for some reason he impressed somebody important. I do not know, but I would suspect it was a kind of friendly appointment, or maybe a political appointment or whatever, but it was not an appointment by somebody who is up to the challenges posed by a major park like the Grand Canyon. River aside, there were many other issues. Among them was the drawing up of a master plan, which was connected into the notion that with the dams no longer a possibility, the park could be expanded, both in the upstream and downstream, to take in parts of the river that the dams were supposed to inundate. These were issues that would be, everybody could see, would be coming in the 1970s.
So the superintendent would have been Lovgren?
Yes, that was Robert Lovgren.
Okay.
He served for about 3 years, as I remember, and was then moved out of there.
And in 1969, then, you were away for 3 years. How did that disconnect happen with the club, and where did you go during this kind of key period when Lovgren was like?
Oh, well, the late 60s were the time when the club decided that David Brower, whatever his virtues, was too much to handle. And he attempted to get elected to the board and maybe become president, I think. A lot of that stuff, and that was pretty much resolved in late 69 and early 60, excuse me, late 68 and early 69, with his quote-unquote firing by the board of directors. The version of the club that was the Brower Club was very different from the version of the club that would come into being after he had left. The charisma that he had shown, that exemplified his public persona in being a spokesman for the club and for environmental issues and so on, that was now removed. And I felt certainly that it was a removal that would affect the club's leadership, which I felt would be taken over by an ethos that I would perhaps pejoratively call bureaucratic. That isn't to say that the new people were not good conservationists or not good environmentalists, but the way they would run the club would be, I don't know, less exciting. I felt less effective. I made one effort to project a different future by talking to the new executive director, Mike McCloskey, and saying I wanted to be conservation director. That post was vacant because Mike had been conservation director, and so when he became executive director after Dave left, the conservation post was left open, and he said to me very transparently, no, I want to continue being conservation director myself, which was foolish, except as a matter of protecting his political base and being sure he didn't have any more trouble than he was already faced with getting the club to keep on running. So there was really, I felt, no future in staying with the Sierra Club. And at that time, I happened to get a job offer back at MIT, and so I left the club.
To do what?
Went to work for the Alumni Fund. It's not relevant, really, to this story. It was an opportunity to go to I'd gone to school at MIT, and it was an exciting place to go. This was a job offer that was not a prime job offer in any real sense, but it was, gave us a chance to do something else, to see what was going on, get out of a situation which was probably going to be disappointing and perhaps even sticky. The one thing I didn't see that it would be good to do would be to have any kind of conflict continue. There'd been enough of that with Brower, and that was a genuine issue, because had he become president, the club would have been, I think, gradually transmuted into a far more leader-oriented club, because Brower was not an institution builder. He was more of a public, had the ability to reach out and become a person who could enthuse the public, who could do issues. But that didn't mean that behind him, underneath him, in the club structure itself, there was a supporting institution for what he was trying to do. He more than once would hire somebody like me or Gary Soucy Washington Representative Bob Waldrop, would hire people and tell them to go to work, but it was not work within a structure which he had said, and you'll report to this. I'm trying to avoid giving the impression that what I wanted was a bureaucratic structure, but because Brower would behave in this way, there was never any institution that he left behind, and if he had been control of the Sierra Club, I don't think he would have built one. So the possibility of it dissipating, being challenged by others, all of that stuff, you know, those what-ifs. Anyway, it's irrelevant because the point is that the Sierra Club was a very volunteer-oriented, that's what it had grown on, was Brower was a volunteer for many years before he became executive director. I suppose in some sense John Muir was a volunteer. So the point was that the strength in the club was in its membership. And the big questions then were, how do you serve that membership? How does that membership get activated? And how does it become effective? Brower's answer to that was, follow my example, I mean, follow my vision. And he was great at communicating that vision. That wasn't McCloskey's way. And so what happened in the years after I left, I can't quite tell you because I left. I didn't participate. I do know that there was an effort by a Brower protege, old friend, who I think, oh, now I'm getting a little scrambled, and this isn't so important because it's all written down somewhere else. He was on the board and he tried to become president, or he was president. Anyway, it was an effort to reestablish a pro-Brower faction in charge of the club. At least that's the way I read it. And I had some conversations with this person, whose name is, I'm sorry, slipping my mind. And so that's what he was talking about, was, you know, we should do this because the club is just going to not become as, it's not going to be as effective. Who knows whether he was right or wrong. He didn't succeed in any case. And McCloskey stayed as executive director for some years. When I came back in 1972, since I had had very good relations with John McComb, who was the Southwest representative who succeeded me in that position, and I think we were good working good working companions and friends as well. And so it was easy to connect in with Grand Canyon issues because he was very interested, knowledgeable about the Grand Canyon.
Can you tell me some about John McComb?
Yeah, let's see. What do I know? He was a graduate student in water resources management, at the University of Arizona, an avid outdoors person. He was one of the principals in founding the Southern Arizona Hiking Club, along with Eber Glendang. He was married at the time to Joanna McComb, who was even more of an outdoors, what do we call them, person? Advocate. I mean use of the outdoors. Lots of backpacking, and almost anything else they could think of, you know, some river running and stuff like that. But lots of traveling around the Southwest and into Mexico and wherever in order to get it, look at places that most people had been little explored in this kind of intensive recreational way. I'm sure the Navajo knew a lot about their own reservation, the land that's now a reservation, but white people didn't, and the Southern Arizona Hiking Club, among them the McCombs and so on, went up there and explored these canyons and discovered this marvelous world of Navajo sandstone. So he was a graduate student. I can't even tell you if he got his degree before he was hired to replace me as a Southwest representative. The thing I remember about John and Joanna was that they had a Volkswagen Bug, and they would by and large just sort of keep it packed, and every weekend would take off for some place or other. I don't know what Joanna did, whether she was, she may well have been employed. She was an excellent drawer, draftsman, draftswoman. I have one of her, a very nice tribute drawing by her. Anyway, so that through these years, they were active in the outdoors, but also active in protecting and trying to protect the outdoors, working within the Southern Arizona Hiking Club, with the local chapter of the Sierra Club, the Grand Canyon chapter, with many others, of course, in that chapter, in order to get areas designated as wilderness. That was one of the big issues in the late 60s and 70s, as I said, both in the Forest Service areas as well as the Park Service areas. And then just protecting places, too. Here it comes. It's raining. All right. So he was a natural choice then, in terms of his knowledge and his experience on the ground, to become my successor as Southwest representative. How he fared for that first 3 years, I can't really tell you, but he seemed to have his feet on the ground when I came back in 72, except that we have this situation on the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon where there really was no active controversy, no active effort to say the river shore is becoming a mess. Environmentally, this is bad. The commercial operators are increasing the numbers of people who are going through without any limit. What is the limit who they can go through? How many people should be going through here? Can we just let 10, 100, 300,000 people go? How do we do this? The Park Service is not exercising its job, its responsibility to regulate and protect, regulate activity and protect the park, or vice versa, actually, protect the environment and regulate the activity. So when I came back in the late summer of 72, September, basically, these were issues which had reached crisis proportions. The crisis was brought to a point because a user of the river named Fred Eisman was a friend of Senator Barry Goldwater's, and he reached Goldwater and said, in essence, "Barry, this is terrible. You've got to tell the Park Service to stop this." And Goldwater, being the kind of person he was, said, "Yes, I agree," and wrote letters, but I'm sure he, in fact, actually talked to people in the Interior Department. And very quickly, days, weeks, whatever, again, this is the sort of thing I cover in my book, the Park Service declared that there would be a limit. There would be no more increases in the use, and it would now start working on more better environmental protection. An example of what environmental protection had meant was that in, and I'm not sure I get this date right, but basically 68, the Park Service had said, well, in order to control human waste, we are going to establish four privies along the river being 280 miles long, which meant, and the trips running anywhere from, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever. This was obviously silly. Everybody, I don't know that everybody did, but I'm sure some people said, you know, that's going to be useless. It's just going to become a stinking mess. So they installed them anyway, in spite, and of course they became stinking messes. And it was clearly not a solution, but it was a beautiful example of why you had to really think hard and get some expertise about how to handle the river. If you're worried about the driftwood and it all being used up, if you're worried about the driftwood being gone and people breaking branches off trees, you've got to do something about saying that you can do this or you can't do this, and you're going to have to figure out how you're going to patrol this, and so on and so forth. So those pressures all became very strong in 1972, and as I say, the Goldwater intrusion reached, at that time it was a Republican administration, and reached into the assistant secretary level, a man named Nathaniel Reed, essentially was probably talked to by Goldwater, that's what I would think, and he then turned around and said to the Park Service, you fix this. We're gonna make a wilderness here, we're gonna get rid of motors, we're gonna limit the increases, and we're gonna fix things up. Go to it. And so the Park Service gave a try, and again, without going through all this, the concessionaires resisted tremendously. They did not want to be regulated.
So at this time, Martin Litton had become a concessionaire.
Yes.
So the journey to wilderness, the journey to control of the river, it seemed like Martin would have been there with you in the trenches in the mid-60s, later into the 60s, but into the early 70s. What happened? How did you see that switch?
Well, again, I have to say, I was not here. 69 was the centennial Powell year. And there was a to-do made, pseudo-Powell trips. And if I remember right, Martin participated in this and, was instrumental in making the recreation of the trip. That's such a silly idea. You can't recreate a trip like that because everybody knows too much in 1969 about what the river was like and so on. So yes, Martin was poised because of his extensive knowledge and because he was willing to do this kind of leadership, public leadership kind of a thing. He was poised to be in a very influential position as far as river policy and what it should be. So let's go back and look at where Martin had gotten, how he'd gotten there. Other people can rehearse his early life, but the point was he too was an avid outdoors kind of person. He also flew a plane. And in the 1960s, 50s? In the 1950s, he had started going down the river. And so far as I know, it would always have been in wooden boats or fiberglass boats. I don't know if Martin ever rode a raft through the river, but if he did, it was a scandal, I'm sure. Or it was something that happened later on in life when he was older and it didn't matter anymore. But the point was, he was a leader in a particular way of using the river, namely rowing small wooden, what were called dories, no use of motors or equipment of that sort. In that capacity, then, he gained knowledge about the canyon. He gained knowledge about rowing down the canyon. He gained prejudices about what the right way was to go down the canyon, which was in these wooden boats. You feel the river instead of smushing it out with the big rubber rafts. Therefore was, as I say, through the 1960s, built himself up, and the trips like the one I took in 66, the trips through most of the 60s were trips he organized by inviting people along and saying, well, it'll cost you $180 or $280 or something like that. Not much, just to cover expenses. And he had three, four boats, And he would invite friends who had boats, so you'd see a trip with five boats or something, and they would go down the river. The trip I went on was 19 days. That was and that was all the way through, all the way down into the Lake Mead part of the canyon, where you were then met by a boat, which would tow you through the slack water. So it was a trip which was suited to the rate of which at which the river moved, and gave you lots of time to stop and do hiking and so on. So that was a standard of a trip, let's say, including travel time to the canyon and back, 3 weeks, wooden boats, the whole feel would be leisurely, but in the rapids exciting, because you were right there and confronting the waves, the rapids, in boats that were clearly smaller than the rapids themselves. So exciting and leisurely both, which is of course the way the river is in the canyon. There's flat, serene stretches, and there's tumultuous rapids, so natural. So yes, the point is that in 1969, Martin was poised, with his experience and with the kind of attitudes he had, pro-wilderness. Oh, and I have to add, of course, remind you that he had been the person who, with Brower, made the presentation to the Sierra Club Board of Directors that instead of just fighting a dam to keep it out of the park, the point was to fight both dams and make sure it didn't get in the canyon. So it was the canyon they were fighting to save. So he had that activist credentials. And there were many other things. I mean, he wanted to protect the places that he went and saw, which is, to me, totally admirable. That's what you do. You don't just go and use them and then who cares? And so he had that behind him, too. So we get to 1969, and then there's that period, 69-70, and the Park Service is saying, we're going to issue contracts, and this is going to become an orderly business proposition with concession rules, just as in other parks. But instead of saying, as the Park Service usually does, and we're going to select a concessionaire by bid or however they do it, I don't truly know, it just said, well, there are 21 of them you all want to do it. Go ahead, we'll give contracts to all 21. An amazing decision, which I'm sure was because of the weakness of the superintendent who was there, Lovegren, his lack of experience, his inability to say, good God, I've got to do something about this, or this is going to be a mess, which is what you'd expect from the tough old superintendent who had been at Yellowstone, and then he came to the canyon and he said, by God, I'm going to rule this place, which is the attitude of many of them, for better or worse, but they're not weaklings. And Lovegren was basically a pushover, and I shouldn't call him that. He would yield. He was a very politically minded. Anyway, so all 21 people who wanted to be concessionaires were allowed to be concessionaires. Martin must have made the decision. I was not talking to him, I don't know. Must have made the decision, aha, this is a worthwhile thing for me to do. I worked for Sunset as travel editor. That was a good job, but I had a conflict with the publisher because he didn't want me to be so politically active, particularly in the magazine. So I quit that job, and whatever I'm doing, maybe I can make a livelihood out of running boats. So he became a commercial operator, and that was a crucial moment. Let me go back. I mean, I don't know if we want to talk about the river too much, but let me go back and look at what happened in, I believe, again, 69, maybe 68, but 69. There were perhaps three or four operators of the large rubber rafts that use motors who were most determined to keep being able to run in the river the way they wanted to with their large boats, taping lots of people down in a somewhat shorter trip than you could do just by using the current of the river. These people, even before the contracts were being issued, formed a lobbying group, Colorado River Outfitters Association. And in their bylaws, whatever, they stated, we want to keep motors. So even though the Wilderness Act clearly applied to Grand Canyon, and even though that question may have been one which should have been settled, you know, after debate, these people had already settled in their own minds. We don't want to give up our motors and our profit-making privileges. We want motors on the river. And we'll fight anybody who does anything else. So here is this group, 69, let's just say, that's ready to fight for their privileges. And here's Martin, who is naturally cast at that point, would have been naturally cast, as a leader who hated motors, who hated the large rubber rafts, who believed in wilderness, who had fought for the Grand Canyon to keep dams out of it, who was ready to launch a little business, so therefore be a businessman. He wouldn't be an outsider like me, who was just coming in and saying, let's be a wilderness. He would be saying, I am a businessman who runs, and I prove that you can run a business using wooden boats instead of big rubber rafts propelled by motors. He chose not to accept that role. Since I did not talk to Martin ever about that, I don't know whether he debated it. I don't know any of the ins and outs of how he came to do that. But by the time I became active in 1972 and 3 on river questions, river issues, and going to concessioners' meetings, Martin was solidly in the concessionaires' camp. Now, what this meant was that the concessionaires saw themselves, regardless of how they conducted their businesses, as having more in common as businessmen confronting the Park Service than they had differences. And the way that they could succeed would be to confront the Park Service working together and not to split up. There was one small effort which was aborted by some of the non-motorized companies. There was one that was much larger than, that is to say, larger in the sense they had more boats, more trips, took more passengers. And that was a company called, Arizona River Travel Adventures, American River Travel Adventure, run by the Elliott family. And they tried. They had some, you know, they thought this is the way to do it and we need to take motors off, we need to have a wilderness. There was another concessionaire, Rob, I forget, who made an effort in this same direction, again, at this same time, this 1969 to 72 period, where he was saying to the Park Service, you need to support wilderness here. He was saying to Lovegren that he was getting people excited about doing that. So there were what I'm trying to say is there were people that if Martin had taken that leadership position, who would have been there to support him. But again, as I say, by the time I get to 1973 and I'm active and seeing these people operate in public, none of that is evident. That is, there is no organized concessionaire group touting wilderness and the ending of the use of motors. to counterbalance the CROA group, CROA, of motor operators. And that was a choice that was in part it was a choice that was made. The choice not to do anything was made easier by the Park Service, because the Park Service didn't do anything to encourage the non-motorized wilderness advocates. Had they been a group, the singular example of that is Lovgren saying in a letter, and probably in other places too, I don't think we can make a wilderness here. I don't think the river is a wilderness. And that was the stance of the Park Service until 1972, when Lovgren was eased out, a new superintendent was brought in, Barry Goldwater made his noise, the Secretariat of the Interior Department said to the Park Service, you fix this. That means no motors, that means wilderness, that means cut the use, fix the environment, and get busy. And that gives us the 1970s, which was a fight through that whole period about what kind of rules and regulations would govern the river management, what was called the Colorado River Management Plan for the Grand Canyon. And that the fight over that lasted until the administration changed in Washington, bringing in the Reagan administration and a fellow named Watt, which changed the political balance sufficiently so that there was no political traction for anybody to accomplish a wilderness. I mean, that's a more complicated issue. Again, it took me 400 pages in a book to describe all the ins and outs. But the point was that it was a controversy which was conducted between a more or less unified group of concessionaires, all 21 of them, working together against the Park Service, against us, all treating themselves as being attacked by the Park Service. Regulation to them was anathema, telling them how to run their business. You don't do that. These were upstanding businessmen. Of course they knew how to do it. All that to the contrary, nobody broke ranks. You could go and talk to individuals, people like Ken Slight, who was a fine conservationist, a person who wanted to give his people real trips down the river, although he hated the notion that he couldn't use driftwood for big fires anymore. The point is that there were people that could have politically organized, formed a group, and allied themselves with the Sierra Club and outside, which would have been natural. I mean, after all, Martin was not a, although he was angry at the Sierra Club for other totally different reasons, had to do with some place called Napomo Dunes and a nuclear power plant and Diablo Canyon. In one sense, it was a Californian issue, but it rose right up to the top of the Sierra Club. It was one of the things that helped in the late 60s, helped split the club in the pro anti-Brower. So it's possible that Martin may have thought, no, the Sierra Club is not my friend anymore. I don't know. If that's what he thought, that would be too bad. And maybe he's done an oral history and has told about his his relations with conservationists, environmentalists. All I know is, as far as the river and the Grand Canyon, that he became indistinguishable from the other operators, the other commercial operators, as a defender of his privileges and a person who was active. In a way that I consider particularly ironic, mean-minded, And I do. Martin had been a private river runner for many years. In fact, there weren't anything but private river runners for many years until Georgie White came along and wanted to charge people and make a living out of it. The crucial change came that in the end of the 60s, when the Park Service said, we're going to have contracts, we're going to regulate this river traffic, the number of people who were doing their own trips was not particularly big in compared to the number of people that the commercial outfitters were pushing through. In addition to that, I think it's fairly clear from the Park Service files that they did not, I hate to put this, it sounds personal. Let me just say that they discriminated against private runners. They made it harder to run as a private river runner than they did as either a passenger. Passengers had no trouble getting on the river. If they wanted to go a commercial trip, they just paid money and got on the river. Private river runners doing it on their own had to jump through all kinds of hoops and were discouraged. They were actively discouraged by the Park Service. And when we got into that 1972 critical point, therefore the private river runners formed less than 1 out of 15 of the number of people who went down the river. And when the Park Service said, okay, we're not going to allow any more increases, that meant that the private river runners weren't going to increase either. Well, that didn't mean that the demand didn't increase. And so therefore, that became one of the issues that, the Park Service was fighting the private river runners, the private river runners were fighting to get a larger share. They were fighting the commercial operators because they didn't operate in the same way, and the commercial operators would criticize the private river runners being irresponsible and even naughty on the river. They'd say, oh, they embarrass our passengers. And of course, then there were the wilderness advocates who, like me, who were saying, no, we want this river to be free of motors and we need to regulate the environmental impact. So there are these corners. Again, if you're talking specifically about Martin Lytton, you're talking about a person who is well-positioned, given his experience as a private river runner, to reach out to those people and say, I sympathize, I know what it was like, what you went through, what you have to do in order to organize a trip, so why don't you ally yourself with my friends who don't like motors and who want a wilderness and blah, blah, blah. Well, he didn't do that. He did the opposite. He made enemies out of them. He attacked them in public. And I think that was, I don't know, that's not a pretty part of Martin's career. And the result of all that was, even after the end of the intense controversy in the early 80s, the private river runners were left at a severe disadvantage, which they never overcome. The Park Service still treats them, discriminates them against them as compared to commercial passengers and commercial river runners. So if you want to say that's one of Martin's legacies, I guess you could, though it was more a legacy of inaction on his part. But the fact remains that when we get to the crucial meeting, the crucial period in November of 1980, there is a concessionaires meeting to discuss the Colorado River Management Plan, which had been produced through the 1970s, which was a decent plan. It wasn't a great plan, it was a decent plan. And the Park Service was trying to implement it. It was being resisted, particularly by the motor operators. And they had a concessionaires meeting up in Flagstaff. The Park Service wheeled out the regional director and there was a brand new superintendent at that time, the old one having died of a heart attack. And other people from the Park Service, and they came and said, this is our plan and this is what we're going to do. And the concessionaires had met the day before and had agreed they would all oppose implementation of this plan. And that included Martin. And Martin stood up in that meeting and he basically defended the privileges of the businessman who, I think it's fair to say, ran the river management at that time. Again, I consider that, thinking back over Martin's career, that was to me a pretty low point. I'm sure if he were here, and this were 1985, and we were discussing this, he would defend himself to the nail. I don't have any doubt that he felt he was doing the right thing. He took lots of people down the river, I guess, on those wooden boats, gave them a great trip, a long trip, charged them an arm and a leg. They were the most expensive trips on the river, though not per day or per mile. But anyway, in that sense, he continued to make a contribution. His leadership in that area, eventually other of the concessionaires began running more rowing trips. I mean, there was no mass conversion or anything like that. I don't even know what the numbers are anymore, but I suppose most people still end up on motorized rafts, which is just a shame. And that's something I haven't said, but it's important to understand that the base point about this is that when you go down in a boat controlled by a motor, where the rate of speed is controlled by a motor, so that you maybe get 4 days and four nights, maybe get five, maybe get a week on the river, you are being cheated. Because even though the Grand Canyon is a wonderful thing and place, and everybody says, oh, wow, the canyon, it's not the way to experience the canyon. As to use Brower's example, it's about as great as starting to run in the front door of the Sistine Chapel with your head tilted back until you run out the other end. It's not the way to see the paintings in the Sistine Chapel, and that's not the way to enjoy the Grand Canyon. It's a wilderness, and it ought to be enjoyed at a wilderness pace, which is foreboding, the pace of the river. And that has not happened, so it's still an issue that ought to be decided by Congress, and which we fought through the 1970s, and which we eventually, as I say, lost because of changes in the political climate of the whole country.
So thinking about this journey through the 70s into the early 80s, the concept of trying to integrate the park and then make the park a wilderness, and that not happening, but the park managing as if, given that Congress hasn't acted, and the park has land that has wilderness potential. So they're holding the resource to be managed as wilderness until Congress decides. Now, looking back from the last day in 2014, do you think the park has done a reasonable job at holding the line from degradation or creep of the resource so that wilderness is still a potential for the future, wilderness designation, still a potential for the future at this park?
Well, the answer to this quick answer to that is certainly yes. Wilderness is long-term. National parks are long-term. The profits of a particular business are short-term. We already know there used to be 21 companies at the beginning of the 1970s, and there are now 14. They've combined, they've died off, they've whatevered. My point being, those businesses are transients. And the way they go through and impact the canyon is a transient. That is to say, you do not have to build a highway to get boats through. All right, so now let's go and answer the question, which is one of the best things that we ever did for the concessionaires, which is by putting pressure on the Park Service about the environmental degradation and by leading into a research program that showed there was degradation and it was a bad shape in the mid-70s, and by some other things such as the invention, not by a river runner, not by a commercial river runner, but by an outside researcher, the invention of a system for carrying out human waste, which containerized it and removed it. So there is, I mean, not pee, but the heavy stuff. Anyway, so those kinds of things, by the time we get to 1978-79, are accepted by the concessionaires. I'd almost say they understand that's the price they have to pay. We can't increase the numbers of people we take through very much, if any. I mean, they found little ways to do it, but they've certainly not done something like doubling the number of people who go and touch, I mean, the number of total trips through the canyon, which was certainly threatened 10 years before. And the river, I'm certain, the river shore is in better shape than it was in 1966 at the end of that trip I took. We have to parse into that somehow the effects of Glen Canyon Dam and the continued operation of that and what it's done. And frankly, I'm not, I don't know who is, competent to say, oh, it's all due to this or it's all due to that. The fact is there are changes. But it's very unlikely that we can say that those changes are basically due to running river trips. Nevertheless, the Park Service has been lax in monitoring environmental effects. They were supposed to, back starting in the 1970s, they were supposed to run a monitoring program to show year by year what was happening at various beaches. That program never really got off the ground. I think now and again they do something. Somebody runs a research trip or something, but regular monitoring is done. But we don't even really know how many people could go down the river if you... Let me step back and say the great conclusion of research on the river in the mid-70s, the intensive program that asks the question, what is the condition of the river? What should we do in order to make it better? The answer to that question was, it is not a matter of how many people go down, it's a matter of what they do when they're down there. So if you regulate the people and their behavior, if you educate the river travelers, and more important, educate the people who take them down, either private boaters or commercial operators, whatever, if they are all aware that this is the way they behave on the river to keep their impact minimal, then that's the best way to make sure that the environment doesn't degrade. Then you can ask the question, okay, so how many people could we send down if we do this? Maybe it is only 5,000 a year. Maybe if you say, well, this is a wilderness, we want it to be designated wilderness, and over the next 500 years, if we continue sending 20,000 people a year or 30,000 people a year, it's going to degrade. We don't want that to happen, so maybe it has to be less. But on the other hand, maybe it can be more. The point is, the Park Service, having started on an answer back in the mid-70s, gave that up and never has revisited. Oh, I don't know whether that's true, but I don't know. Never has really revisited that. Their standard line is, we have to worry about environmental degradation along the river, and therefore we're not going to increase use much at all. I truly don't know what the superintendent... What would the superintendent's line be today if I asked him? I don't know. I think he would probably just fudge the answer and say, well, we'll take a look at that when we get to the next river management plan procedure, and I would say he should live so long. But anyway, it has not been a happy experience in public involvement. Public involvement was heavily on the side of wilderness, heavily on the side of getting rid of motors, heavily on the side of environmental protections and all of that throughout the 1970s and into that political change moment of 1980-1981. There would have been plenty of opposition from concessionaires, the commercial river operators, and the passengers that they would stimulate to write letters. But the larger public, both in environmental sense and just in general, would have supported the Park Service had they done it. And had they done it, had there been a wilderness environmental river plan put into operation in 1980, 81, it would be a river that would be greatly enjoyed, I would even say far more enjoyed by more people perhaps, but in good condition today. All these issues that we fought about in the 70s were decided wrong as far as the longevity goes, because anybody who takes that, all you have to do is you take a boat person, a person who operates a large motor rig, and you ask them, how would you like to go down the river by yourself with your friends? And they don't say, oh, I want a big, powerful motor. I want a hard-hulled motorboat so I can really rip down the... What they say is, I'd like to row. At least that's the cliche, and I believe it. That was, therefore, another ironic twist that even the people who had such great experience with these trips, they had a job and they wanted to protect it. So I don't feel as if this is a settled question. I feel in the long run, the protection of the canyon would benefit from wilderness designation, from the removal of motors in large trips. I believe it would, the experience of being in a national park, which after all is one of the Park Service's mandates, or things they should care about, that experience would be enhanced for every visitor on the river if all the trips were rowing trips. The people on the rowing trips, that's sort of obvious because they're in a great situation. The people who are now having to go through in motors, again, no question. So instead of degrading other people's experience, they would have a better experience themselves. So anyway, my conclusion, and I have, during the 1980s, I was complete, in most of the 1990s, I was completely inactive. And this was a period of consolidation of the commercial river runners' operations, control over the river, to the point where no superintendent would dare attempt to do what I just suggested was best for the river. It's interesting then to look at the superintendency of Steve Martin, who was a river ranger in the mid-1970s. As such, he participated in the formulation of the wilderness anti-motor, pro-environmental river management plan that was offered by the Park Service in the late 1970s up to 1980. When he became park superintendent, you would never know that. There was nothing left of that enthusiastic ranger who knew the river, who had worked on a decent plan, who defended it in public, and by the time he comes back as superintendent, you know, excuse me, I have something else to do. And I think that's the kind of, here's another example. The research program in the 1970s, which documented massively the degradation that was being done, was one of the principal investigators was a man named Stephen Crothers, a biologist who was working for the Museum of Northern Arizona at that time. He's also the one who I think takes principal credit for the self-contained waste disposal system that was eventually developed. When the last time I talked to him, and therefore I should say he was all in favor of getting rid of motors, all in favor of environmental protection, in favor of the mark of the Park Service river management plan that was developed at that period. He then left the Museum of Northern Arizona and built a business as a consultant, environmental consultant, devised fake rocks, boulders, and all kinds of things like this, became rich, moved to Hawaii, and the last time I saw him, which was probably 2001, 2, something in there, he was all in favor of the status quo with motors. You know, when you understand people and the politics, how they get involved in things and what leads them to change their minds or keep their views the same or whatever, that's not surprising. You know, there's a lot of different ways of people to react, for people to react to issues. But that's a disappointment too. Not that it's Carruthers, during the period of the 70s, he was fine. Unlike Martin, that's my point. He's different from Martin. But eventually they got to him too, or the ideas did, or whatever. So I think in balance, it's a sad episode in environmental history. The history of the national parks, this will not be something that can be celebrated, I think.
It seems as though the national park system as a agency responsible for over 400 different unique areas is trying to work a balance between preserving these resources and being dictated to by Congress through special interest, Grand Canyon legislation for the river that assisted in the Reagan-Watt transition time, the overflights, recent McCain and Reed, a little bit of legislation to help the overflights companies do more flights in the canyon. What are your thoughts on political special interest manipulation of the agency and its resource?
Well, loaded question, but let's take the one you just mentioned, the overflights. Most of that, again, that was during a period, even though there were already attempts by the Park Service to do something about overflights in the 70s, it didn't become a major issue until the 1980s. And of course, it became a legislative issue too. Now, McCain was a central legislator in trying to control air traffic after there were a couple of accidents. So maybe his concern wasn't natural quiet. Maybe his concern was more safety. He was a pilot. But by today, when you talk to McCain, he's on the side of the of not putting pressure on the operators. When you look at the Hualapai situation, the situation at the western, down in the western end of the canyon, where you have the land on the south bank is in the Hualapai Reservation, and they have built a business. They too make choices. Their vision of the canyon is, of course, shown by the choices they make. You can ask, well, are the choices they make their own, or are they heavily influenced by commercial interests who come in and say, look, you could do this, this, and this and make money for your tribe. The amount of helicopter traffic in the western end of the canyon, in this vicinity, this little area where the Wallapai have established landing points or takeoff points for helicopters, the situation there is so anti any kind of park, wilderness, I mean, didn't even say the word, natural scene experience. This is a mechanized, routinized, mass industrial tourism thing. You put your dollars into the turnstile, you shuttle on, you fly down, you're given a stale sandwich, you get back on, you fly out, you get out and you get on a big motorboat and it goes up and down the river for a few minutes, and then you get flown back to Las Vegas so you can spend the rest of your money. That's what can you say about something like that? It has just nothing to do except that it is their vision of the Grand Canyon. And anybody who knows about that, anybody who has dealt with the overflight legislation and was involved, as McCain was, in the mid-80s with passing that legislation and trying to bring some balance or something, quiet, back to the parks, and now sees what's going on and how it's all turned out, would have to be, I don't know, heavily disappointed. Again, it's not something that I'm personally involved in, so I'm hesitant to say why and how, but it just looks to me like it's the same kind of thing. I go back again. The initial instinctive reaction of the riverboat operators who ran rafts with motors in the 1968-69 period, their initial reaction was to form a protective organization which, as explicitly saying, keep motors on the river. That's so, that politically, there's no problem with understanding that. Philosophically, it makes you wonder about human beings and their inability to, I don't know what, improve the world. It sounds lame. But they were people who had a chance to make a difference. Martin was a person who had a chance to make a difference. McCain is a person who has a chance to make a difference. And they don't do it. And I don't mean make a difference in the sense that, oh, I don't know anything about this. These are people who knew something about it, many of them deeply experienced. And they took a position that was a position for change. And now they don't. What is that about? So the canyon offers you the not just something about the history of parks, but the history of how people deal with parks, and makes you ask the question, what do they understand a park is? And you can ask that question about park service people, superintendents, all the way up to superintendent. How many people have we met who are 20 or 30, enthusiastic, protect the parks, make sure that things don't get degraded, let people use the parks so they have a good time, and then when you talk to them 20 years later and they're superintendents, none of that is left. It's all, well, we have to, you know, we have to protect the concessionaires. We have to, I don't know, do all those rules and regulations which make it hard for people to enjoy their parks. We don't trust people to enjoy the parks. And yet, interpretive services are probably the ones that have suffered the most in the Park Service over the years. I don't have the figures, but we know just from watching, police services are, it's a boom in the parks. but what they contribute to a person's, people's understanding and appreciation and enjoyment. How many park rangers lead groups of people down into the canyon or are stationed in the canyon and talk to people that come down? I don't know. Yeah. So I'm not sure that answered your question, but the point was, to me, that the impact of commercial operations is, at least in the case of the canyon, I can document that it is antithetical to the Park Service Organic Law, the principles of that law, and the Wilderness Act, the laws which supposedly govern the national park operation. Grand Canyon and other ones, but it's particularly for the Grand Canyon. So it's therefore it makes it difficult not to come to the conclusion that profit is more important than protection. And of course we see that, we don't have to talk just about the Park Service, we see that in this conflict on the eastern end of the Grand Canyon where a developer comes along and says, hey, I want to do this. And it just seems like people say, oh yeah, let's consider this seriously, where it's obviously a stupid idea of no merit whatsoever. Something that should, where people should say, you do, and they should lynch him. They should tar and feather him. I mean, that's the proper response to that. But instead, the Navajo tribe is, quote unquote, seriously considering it, I guess. Maybe they're just stringing him along. It's always possible the Navajo are extremely clever. And they say, let's see what we can get out of this guy. But, so it's a never-ending problem. Parks are, just like the whole West, targets. A huge, sprawling land with buried riches, minerals, with forests, with forage, and by and large, people just came and stripped it. And we have a few places left, like forests, wildernesses, parks. And maybe we can keep them protected. Maybe.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview? Something else you'd like to make sure you cover?
Well, the reason that I finally ended up using the blog form to write about the canyon is that I found trying to write a book, well, I wrote a book about the river controversy. It is over 400 pages long, and it is not the time that it took, but, and it I should say, and I had a fair amount, not all the possible sources, but a fair amount of the sources to tell the story. And that was one small, important, but small issue as far as the Grand Canyon is concerned over the some, depending on how you count, who you include, 100, 200 years or more of its being something that people have talked about, tried to consider what to do with, tried to dispose of, tried to despoil, tried to protect. And the whole point of the blog was then, well, if I try and write a book that includes everything else, there will either be a massive series, which doesn't even interest me, or else it'll be a massive book, which doesn't interest me either. So the idea of the blog is, okay, let's write about mining. There's this whole funny business going on about uranium prospecting because the price of uranium has gone up and that brings out the leeches anyway. And so there's topics about, and they may not be connected except in the fact they take place in and around the canyon. And therefore they contribute to what could be considered a comprehensive political history. How people have treated the canyon, what decisions they've made, what went into their making decisions. And I can see that as just a continuing project. Again, the question of the development that's been proposed for the eastern end of the canyon at the confluence with the Little Colorado, that's a very separable issue from, say, grazing leases on the Shiblets Plateau, which is an equally interesting question. How come there isn't any grazing anymore? When the park was being expanded in 1970s, grazing out there was one of the things we had to take into account. Now there isn't any. So there's a story there to be told, because it's human activity and human decisions, and some of the ones are Park Service decisions. So it's still a lot of stuff. And the reason I would write this is not that it's all one happy story showing how the Grand Canyon is worth protecting and people respond to it. There's a lot of that element in it, of course, particularly in the story about the dams. And even, I would say, in the somewhat less intense story about expanding the park, and then negatively in the story about the river and why motors and commercial interests dominate in the management of river traffic. But I would say that my philosophy, you asked about long into the future, the point is that there are, there are several different landowners. There's the federal government. There's the federal government with different agencies, Forest Service, Park Service, Bureau of Land Management. And there are private landowners, Havasupai, the Waldwai, the Navajo being principal ones. All of them have different, perhaps subtly different, but actually quite different ideas about what to do with the Grand Canyon, how to relate to the Grand Canyon. What they can take out of the Grand Canyon, what they might do to protect the Grand Canyon, whatever. Those philosophies are all, no matter what the origin of the various owners, are all human beings. They're all different responses of human beings to this place. And it is a continuously interesting question and will continue to be. So if you can somehow keep looking comprehensively, that is, even though it's one at a time, all the issues that are dealt with by these different people at different times, you're going to get an evolving picture of how people react to one, let's call it, world environmental icon, someplace which is known around the world. I exaggerate, but nevertheless, we like to believe that's true. How do they react to it, and what does that say about them, and what does it say about human beings, and what does it say about our ability to protect our environment, the environment that supports us? So to me, it's not a question of pessimism or optimism. It's a continually interesting and evolving question.
And that's what you're trying to do with your blog, is just explore that continuing evolving question.
Yeah, by looking at itsy-bitsy pieces. The long section, which I have carried up into about 1975, on the history of the park, where the park came from, why has the boundaries it does, is, if you will, a response on how the dominant and excuse the expression, white folk society, its political legal structure, how it was used to protect and not quite protect the Grand Canyon. I mean, protect having a certain legal meaning, actually, but beyond that, just the sense that we all have when we look at it and we say, no, we don't want to build dams there. That's not right. It doesn't belong there. And so in looking at the park, we say, so why does the park have the shape it does? So that we can look at some place and know that there isn't a highway going to be built through it, along it. So those are the those are the ways those are the strands I would try and draw out of the story, like where did the park come from and why were the decisions made. I don't know that that always happens. Sometimes you just, it's so easy to get caught up in telling the story and the details and forget that, oh, we've got to say, now what does this mean? Why do these people behave this way? Why do the commercial river operators fight wilderness? Is it just money in their pocket, or are they afraid? Wilderness is a dangerous place. We don't want to have a wilderness. And something might bite our rafts at night. You know, it's, and I think those questions are one that the canyon poses for us and will continue to pose for us. It's not a victim. It's not a, it's often thought of as a target, but the target is usually other people who have the right or the ability to stop somebody from doing something or encourage somebody from doing it. It's not that the Little Colorado and the Colorado are going to rise up and thwack the developers of this terrible idea out in the East End. That's got to be other people. So again, it's a question of people and their visions and what the canyon inspires in them or doesn't inspire in them.
Thank you, Jeff.
My pleasure. It's always fun to talk about the canyon with a knowledgeable person.
I didn't have to say anything. This is good.
Oh, I don't know.
All right, let's turn this off.